Blog Talk Radio. With two New York Times best-selling novelists and a comma queen. We'll also give away the books we're featuring on this episode of the Literary New England Radio Show as we talk with Marisa de los Santos, whose newly released novel, The Precious One, tells the story of half-sisters Taisy and Willow, who aren't the best of friends when their father brings them together. As Marisa explains, The Precious One is about family secrets, lost love, and dangerous obsession. And many readers may find elements that hit close to home.
Someone says to me, and I was going through a really hard time in my life, and your book helped get me through. I think, what a great job I have.
Mary Norris, a longtime copy editor at The New Yorker, will also be here to talk about her warm and humorous memoir, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. I love this book, as will anyone who cares about and believes in the power and necessity, not just of language, but of precise language. One of the many places Between You and Me takes us is to explore some of the questionable, if not confounding, grammar choices found in some of classic literature, including those pieces of literature that are steeped in New England.
From the very first instance of the use of Moby Dick as the title, it had the hyphen, so it was something a copy editor would have done.
Also, to celebrate the paperback release of The Last Enchantments, a standalone literary novel written by Charles Finch, who is author of the Charles Lennox Mystery Series, I brought back part of a fun and lively interview I did with Charles shortly after The Last Enchantments came out in hardcover. Like most of his books, The Last Enchantments is set in England.
There's nowhere else where you feel as if you're walking through 100 different periods of history at the same time.
I'm Cindy Wolf Boynton, and I think we'll start off tonight's Literary New England Radio Show with Charles, a graduate of Phillips Academy in Massachusetts and Yale University in Connecticut. When Charles and I spoke last year, the eighth book in his Charles Lennox mystery series, The Laws of Murder, hadn't yet been published. Now it's a bestseller, and fans are anxiously awaiting for the ninth book, Home by Nightfall, which won't be published until November of this year. Until then, however, those who haven't yet given The Last Enchantments a try might want to pick up the new paperback version, which takes readers to a fictional Oxford, England college town, very much like the one Charles himself attended. So what is this fast-paced and psychologically intriguing novel all about?
It covers 1 year in the life of Will Baker, who's a disillusioned young political worker who decides to sort of leave for America in for England in 2005. So what we hope is that it's sort of an updated version of Brideshead Revisited, maybe for the 21st century.
So what made you decide to take this little sidestep? I guess not a little sidestep, because it took you several years to write. What made you decide to do this project?
You know, I have always loved the mystery novels I write, which are set in Victorian England. But what I read tends to be a lot of contemporary fiction. And so, in a way, this is sort of me coming back to my strongest interest from what I would consider a side project, but which has turned out to be the main channel of my career, which is the mystery novels. So I always had it in mind to be a literary novelist. I think it's just a slower process for me. I can write a mystery novel in a few months, and it takes a few years to write a literary novel.
Well, that's really interesting. So you've published how many mystery novels? Seven,
which seems like a huge number, but
it is a huge number because I'm looking at your picture and you look like you're 21.
No, I'm 33, and so I've been...
Okay, so you're still this little baby for many of us, and you've written, like, this whole series, and you have another one that's coming out in several months.
That's right, yeah. I wrote the first one almost sort of just on a lark. I always loved Sherlock Holmes and Elizabeth Gaskell and Anthony Trollope and all these Victorian writers, and I just sat down one day and started to write the story, and then... I got a contract to do another one and then another one, and it's just sort of, I'm in a comfortable rhythm now, and I love the world they're set in. So it's just sort of, you do one a year and then they add up. It's funny.
And the world they're set in is what world? It's, Victorian England?
Yeah, it's London and the home counties from around 1865 to 1875 so far, and it's all centered on this one detective who's sort of a gentleman detective, as they're called, and he sort of has this little universe of Confederates, and he solves crimes and has a family and stuff, and there's seven books, so it's now several thousand pages about this guy, which I didn't anticipate, but it's been really fun.
So where did he come from?
That's a great question. I don't know. I started writing the first one when I was 23 or 24, and he's this sort of 40-year-old, very staid person. So I'm not sure what I felt like I had in common with him. I just sort of, he popped into my head, and I've been interested in him ever since.
But you have the same first name.
Yeah, that's a funny story. I was originally going to publish the mystery under a pseudonym, because as I sort of described, I wanted to write literary fiction more seriously, and then at the last minute I included his name as mine as a little sort of inside joke for my friends and family, and the last minute my mom said, please just publish it under your own name so I can show it to my friends. So I ended up just doing that, and it was too late to change his name.
Oh my goodness, what we do for our moms.
Exactly. I don't regret it.
So I'm so curious about you. I know that you, or it seems, I believe that you split your time between the U.S. and the U.K. I think you live in Chicago now. You went to school in high school in Massachusetts. You went to college at Yale. Like, who are you, and did you always want to be a writer?
That's a tough question. Did I always want to be a writer? I think I always... loved fiction more than anything. And so I think there are definitely times for any writer where it's the last thing on the world you want to do, and you wish you were an astronaut or a baseball player or anything.
Sure.
But I always felt the sort of compulsion to write fiction. So I always wanted to write. I think it takes a lot of just sitting at a desk and writing to be a writer, which is not the most fun part. So it's kind of a mix of love and effort.
But when you went to college, what did you get your degree in?
Oh, sorry, yeah. I double majored in English and history. So for a while I thought about maybe being a professor. And then I went to Oxford and studied medieval and Renaissance literature. So I thought again about maybe dedicating my life to that, specifically like Shakespeare. But in the end I decided that I'd rather just be a novelist.
So does that study that you did mean that you have a Renaissance era or a medieval historical novel inside you waiting to come out?
You know, that's such a good question. I would love to do one. My one worry is that I think the voice is really hard to do. I think the Victorian period is recent enough that the voice is just slightly different without being dramatically different, but the voice of Renaissance England, as anyone who's gone to see Hamlet at the theater or whatever can tell you, is so different. And I think Hilary Mantel has done an incredible job. She just wrote this
absolutely
of sort of triangulating between, you know, historical fiction is always a truce between what we can get away with and the truth. It's never quite the truth, and I think she's gotten the closest to capturing that voice. So I would love to do it in terms of the history. I find that period fascinating. It was much more liberated in a lot of ways than Victorian England, but I would have to be 100% confident in the voice and in the dialogue. So maybe after some serious thought. I wouldn't go into it lightly.
So now, is it true what I said, that you split your time between the U.S. and the U.K.?
You know, I'm actually about to see my first child, so we are now permanently settled in the U.S. But we, for a while, yeah, we're in both, my wife and I, and we still go back to the U.K. as often as possible.
Now, I think that that is definitely, you're someone who lives the best of both worlds, because I think there is something just so incredibly magical about England, about the London era, the London area especially. I don't know what it is. I've been there several times, but there's just something about London. I don't know. I find it so compelling, and I don't know if it's the history. I don't know if they're ghosts. I don't know if I lived there in a past life. I don't know what it is, but I just can't go back there enough.
I completely agree. I think, you know, there's nowhere else where I think you put your finger on it. I think where you feel as if you're walking through 100 different periods of history at the same time. Everywhere else, you know, I grew up in New York City, for instance, and there, if your store doesn't succeed within 6 weeks, they tear it down and put up something new. But in England, everything has time to sort of accrete and to grow. So you can go from the Tower of London over to Barnes & Noble, over to, you know, London Bridge. And it's this sort of, like, incredible feeling of time travel.
Yeah, it really is. Now, we've gotten a little bit away from The Last Enchantments, but your protagonist, William Baker, he is also a Yale graduate.
Yeah.
Is he you? In some sense?
Right. I think, I think that there's definitely an autobiographical element to the book, and I think that, you know, all fiction is autobiographical. I think my Victorian novels are in a way, too. This is, some of the facts in this are not directly based on my life, but he definitely has the, I think, temperament and worldview that I have, which is a little disturbing because a lot of the reviews are like, I don't like the narrator, but so be it.
Well, that's all right.
Yeah,
as long
life.
As they like the story, it doesn't matter if they really like the narrator that much or not.
I agree. I don't think you need to love every character. I think it's more interesting to have characters who are human.
So now, if someone has never read a Charles Finch book,
mm-hmm.
where do they start? Do they start with The Last Enchantments, or do they go to one of your mystery novels?
That's a good question. I think I would start with The Last Enchantments, or if you really love mysteries, there's one I really like called A Burial at Sea, which is the fifth in the series, and it's my favorite. It was my favorite one to write. It takes place on a sea voyage between London and Egypt.
Okay, and I don't believe you have a website, but you do have a very active Facebook page.
That's right. It's just facebook.com/Charles Finch Author.
And do you enjoy the interaction that you get with readers there?
Yeah, you know, I was really skeptical about social media for a long time, and now I feel stupid because I'll post a question like, what are you guys reading this week? And there will be 95 responses, and my library list will double in length, and it's great. It's been so wonderful.
That's great. Mm-hmm. And what do you want people to know about you as an author?
Whew, what a difficult question. I think what I'd like people to know me about me as an author.
Interpret it as you like.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like I'm on the analyst couch. Let me think. I think, I think that I write books that will appeal to people who love England, which I hope is a lot of people, because I grew up as a teenager reading, as I said, these books, Dickens or Arthur Conan Doyle or Agatha Christie, where England was so vivid in my mind, and now all these books I've written are set there. So if you have that sort of sense of England, if you like, you know, Downton Abbey, or if you like Masterpiece Theater or something, or if you like those books, I think that my work might appeal to you.
Win a copy of The Last Enchantments by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Do the same to win a copy of Marisa de los Santos's The Precious One, a captivating novel about friendship, family, second chances, and the redemptive power of love.
The Precious One is there's a lot going on in the book, but at the heart of it is the relationship that develops between two half-sisters, Paisy, who's in her mid-30s, and Willow, who is 16. They have very little in common except for a father. And Taisy is close to estranged from her father. She lives in a different state, rarely sees him, has been holding out hope, really, for 17 years, that he would kind of come back into her life and be a real father to her. Hasn't happened yet. And then Willow is the child of Wilson, is the name of the father, a second marriage. And she's sort of his second chance child. And he is extremely protective. She lives a very sheltered life. And Wilson homeschools her. She doesn't, you know, have television, any of that kind of stuff. And Wilson, at the beginning of the book, has suffered a pretty severe heart attack, has had surgery. And to Taisy's amazement, he calls her and asks her to come for an extended stay at his home, which is back in the town that she left 17 years ago. And Taisy and Willow are in each other's lives for the very first time. They've never really known each other. They've only known about each other. And there's quite a bit of tension and jealousy and suspicion between the two of them. So there's the heart of the story is how they kind of plunge into a relationship that neither one of them is quite ready for, and what happens after that.
So did the story come from something you or someone you knew experienced?
Not really. You know, the funny thing is that I've really just been thinking about second chances. And, you know, maybe it's my age, but I know a lot of people who are embarking on sort of new lives. Maybe not to the extent Wilson did, where they completely cut off their first life. But they, and it got me thinking that we often get those stories from the point of view of the person who is embarking on the new life, not from the people who are left behind in the old life. And that's what got me started. And then the interesting thing was, it wasn't until, I know this sounds crazy, but it wasn't until I was finished with the book that it really occurred to me that I am part of my father's second chance family. You know, that he was, when I was 14, I found out that he'd been married before in the Philippines, where he's from. I grew up in the United States and was born here. And had no idea until then that I had two half-brothers. And it's a long story, but it's like, you know, I was the Willow in that story. And I don't know, there's a kind of full circle thing happening for me personally, and then writing a story about that. But it wasn't something I set out to do. It's sort of something that was there, I'm sure, in my subconscious, and then after I wrote the book, I was like, oh, you know what's weird?
Yes, isn't that, you know what, our subconscious is such a strong and surprising thing.
Yeah, it really is. And as a writer, you know, there's so much that we write about, and people will say, where'd you get the idea? And I'll say, I have no idea, but of course it's all in there, you know, and it's all part of memory and history and personal experience. But none of my books really reflect my own life, but in some ways, of course, they do, you know.
Well, sure. And actually, I was going to ask you, and you kind of answered this, you know, do we see more of you in Taisy or in Willow? And you said a few minutes ago you are sort of the Willow.
Well, you know, I am the Willow as a personality and as a character. I mean, Willow was a really interesting character to write because she has really led an incredibly sheltered life. At 16, she, after her father's heart attack, because he was really in charge of her education, he, and for reasons of his own, he sends her to school for the first time. So she's negotiating high school and all of the craziness and all of the social pressures and of that. And it's almost like she is a creature who evolves on an island and then is suddenly thrown into a different environment and has just not developed any of the skills that kind of keep you afloat in high school. And that wasn't me. You know, I mean, I was a pretty normal kid. And in fact, I feel in some ways more akin to Tazy, who is in her mid-30s and is searching for her, you know, her life and in many ways. And but yes, there's certainly a combination there of in both characters. But at the same time, as I write them, and even before I start writing the book, they have become totally separate from anyone I might know, including me, and are their own personalities and their own, you know, I really experience my characters as real people once I get going. And so in some ways it becomes hard to see those similarities once they become full-fledged, full-blown people to me. But yeah.
So I'm curious about the writing process, because The Precious One is told from two points of view, from both Tazy's and Willow's voices. When you wrote it, did you write one and then the other, or did you actually go back and forth, or how did you do it?
I wrote the chapters in the order in which they appear. So I, you know, they start with Tazy and end with Tazy. And I would write one voice and the other. And, you know, I always have to take a day or two in between to kind of lose the old voice, especially in the beginning, and take on or channel or whatever the new voice. Eventually it becomes very second nature, because the voices truly come out of who the characters are. And I get to know them better and better as the writing process goes on. So they become very natural to me. In the beginning, I really have to make a conscious effort between chapters to switch gears. And it's not always easy.
Yeah, I can imagine. And if I'm counting right, this is your fourth book?
This is my fourth novel for adults. I have a novel that I co-wrote with my husband for middle grade readers. So that sort of middle school, I don't know, 8 to 13 age group, that came out last spring.
Saving Lucas Biggs.
Saving Lucas Biggs. So the paperback of that will come out this spring. And then we have a second one that we've written together coming out in September. But I kind of have two hats, and that's my middle grades hat, and this is my, with my adult hat on, yes, this is my fourth.
Oh, I think that's really neat that you write with your husband.
You know, it is really fun. And it's a very different experience from writing by yourself. And a lot of people say, oh my gosh, you must have argued all the time. You know, we really didn't. I mean, we had a couple moments when we really had to hash things out, and we were kind of coming from different directions at what we wanted to have happen. But for the most part, it was enormous fun. We lived and breathed it together, which you usually do on your own. Writing can be so solitary, so it was fun to have those arguments that you usually have with yourself, or those moments when you're unknotting difficult problems. Usually it happens with conversations in your own head. This happened with conversations with my husband. So that was really, it was pretty great. We had a lot of fun doing it. And we had our own voices and our own chapters. So it was structured similarly to The Precious One, except that I wrote the 13-year-old girl chapters, and he wrote the 13-year-old boy chapters, and they alternated. If we tried to craft sentences together, I think that would have been rough going. But
yeah, that's probably a good way to do it.
Yeah, I can't imagine doing it any other way.
And Marisa, for fans of your adult fiction, are they going to see something in The Precious One that perhaps they haven't seen in your earlier works?
You know, this is the first book I've done. I've often done alternating points of view. This is the first book I've done with two first-person voices. My book Love Walked In had the alternating points of view, but one was third person and only one of them was first. So there's that, which was really fresh for me as a writer, and challenging and exciting. I'm always focused on relationships. Nothing's more interesting to me than the way people, you know, bump up against each other in their lives and what happens when they come together. So there's certainly there's consistency, but this focus on the sister relationship, which is such an interesting relationship. I have a sister. And even though they've been separated, when they come together, there's so much commonality, I think, with just everyone who's had a sister. It's a pretty intense relationship. You share so much. You're rivals to some extent. You come to support each other when that's called for always. I mean, it's an interesting and intense relationships, and the intense ones are the ones that really fascinate me the most.
One of the things that caught my attention about The Precious One is that it's a dad story, and I'm sure that now I'm going to have, you know, a two dozen people tell me that I'm absolutely wrong with what I'm about to say. But from my point of view, there are so many mom stories, and there really aren't enough dad stories.
You know, that's really interesting. I think a lot of dad stories we get are possibly from the point of view or involve a father-son relationship, which I think often we think of as very fraught and complicated. But as a daughter, I think that relationships with fathers can be just as complicated and confusing. What is happening with Taisy in particular is that logically she knows. I mean, this man has never been a good father to her, and then their family kind of self-destructed when she was in a senior in high school, and she moved away with her mother and her brother, and she knows intellectually that she should not care what this man thinks of her. She should not care if they have a relationship or if he loves her, because he really hasn't been good enough. But she can't help it, you know, and there's this tie there that pulls her back all the time. So when in the beginning of the book opens with a phone call from him where he kind of very grandly summons her to come see him after his heart attack. And she knows, of course, that she should say no. And her brother, her twin brother, says, oh, you know, he wouldn't go for $100 million, and she can't help it, you know. And I get that. I think that there's a very powerful link between daughters and fathers, and this real desire for approval that, you know, is hard to let go of, even when everything's telling you you probably should.
Oh, definitely. And now I know you have a very active Facebook page. Is hearing from readers something that you enjoy?
Oh, I love to hear from readers. And I love, I'm about to embark on a tour and meeting readers. I'm not great with plane travel and hotel rooms, but it's all worth it when, you know, you're there at the event and you actually meet people. Because when you write, you know, I mean, even this is my fourth book for adults, my fifth novel, it's still, during the writing process and until the book's really out there, until you start getting feedback, there's part of me that can't believe that anyone except like my mom and my sister and my husband have read my books, you know? It kind of, and sometimes I'll get messages from readers from Poland or something. I'm like, oh no, this isn't possible. You know, this is so crazy. But it's humbling, and it's such an honor. And, you know, my readers, many of them are people, when I encounter them on social media or in person, I just think, you know, we could be friends. If you lived in my neighborhood, we would be friends, you know. And we end up having really great interactions. So, I'm excited. I get nervous before book tours because I am a very, like, anxious flyer and packer, and nobody wants to be around me when I'm packing for a trip. but it's such an honor and a privilege, and just also fun to be there and talk to people who have read your books and to whom your books matter, because that's what we want. We want them to matter. When someone says to me, and I was going through a really hard time in my life and your book helped get me through, I think, what a great job I have. You know, what a, this is, I'm glad to be doing this. I'm so grateful.
Marisa, you just perfectly ended our conversation right there. That was the perfect wrap-up. Thank you so much for talking today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
I could have talked with Mary Norris for hours about her new book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. She's lovely and hysterical, full of personality, and like me, she loves words. But her memoir, Between You and Me, is no guidebook. Yes, when you read it, you hear and learn about vexing grammar problems like comma faults and dangling modifiers, using who versus whom, and what to do when general neutral language is needed. But the book is so much more, drawing on examples from Charles Dickens, Henry James, the TV show The Simpsons, David Foster Wallace, Gillian Flynn, and other works. Mary delves into all aspects of language usage in this book, but I want her to be the one to explain.
Well, it grew out of commas, in fact, because I wrote a piece about commas for the New Yorker's website. Some young women had come to my door and told me that some guy wrote a piece for the Times making fun of New Yorker commas. And, you know, the New Yorker does use a close punctuation system. We do put commas in where we feel they're needed, and not everybody follows this same system. There's there are many journalistic outlets that are a lot looser. So that's fine. It's just that our tradition is to use a lot of commas. Sounds a little bit funny, but there's a reason for every one. Anyway, I was able to write this piece because I was inspired by being in possession of the comma shaker that a woman at work had made, somebody who had been a legendary proofreader. She had a canister with a perforated lid, and she wrapped brown paper around it and drew commas on it and wrote on it commas, and that was her comment on the New Yorker's style with commas. She thought we used too many. But she was herself the, you know, she was somebody who was a very stern proofreader, and she it was her job to put those commas in too, so she enforced it even though she didn't always like it. So that's how it started. I was surprised. I'd been trying to be a writer, an author, for, it's no exaggeration to say, decades. And I'd had a little bit of success at The New Yorker, writing talk stories and outside The New Yorker. But nothing that I wrote was as popular as this blog post on commas.
That's hysterical.
So I began to write about other New Yorker style things, the diaresis that we use, the more than occasional profanity that now sneaks into the magazine. And I was able to get in touch with an agent and ask if he thought there'd be any interest in a collection of these things. And he was interested. He was enthusiastic. I got a book contract. And it turned out, though, that once I had the contract, the editor wanted something that was more than a collection of blog posts. He wanted something that could be read from beginning to end and that had a story built into it. And so my whole career and my whole personal history have parts in this story, and I've tried to weave commas and explanations of the objective case, as in Between You and Me, and apostrophes and semicolons and hyphens. I've tried to give them all an interesting background so that it's not painful to read about.
Well, and grammar can be a very painful thing, but you really have created a story, and a story with a wonderful sense of humor.
Oh, thank you. I do think it's important to entertain people. Well, you teach, so you know that you do have to entertain to get across your points.
you do have to entertain, but sometimes you also have to do wild tricks and handstands when you're talking about things like grammar, because there just is such an inherent fear of it. Why do you think that is?
Well, it must come from early childhood. It's stuff that people already know, but they're afraid they don't know it. I've noticed that even people of my generation, or I'm actually old now, but people in middle age, they're afraid it's slipped. They're afraid they don't know anymore the proper use of commas, and they want a refresher, and they're very insecure. It's true.
So in this book, you cover much more than commas. You take us back into classic literature and look at punctuation and grammar that's used in works by Emily Dickinson and Henry James. You look at the work of Gillian Flynn. You take us back to Noah Webster. And I love it that you take us on a journey to find out who put the comma in Moby Dick. And I mean, the hyphen, rather, in Moby Dick. And I want to know who put that hyphen in Moby Dick, because it does not belong there.
Well, it was traditional in the 19th century to put hyphens in the titles of books. If you've been to the New York Historical Society, that's another place. They hyphenate New York because that building was built in the 19th century, probably the early 19th century, when New York was hyphenated. And it's engraved in stone now, so they have to keep it. You know. But what happened with Moby Dick, as you know, the whale himself did not use the hyphen. Throughout the book, Moby Dick is two words with no hyphen. But when it came time to title the book, Melville did change the title. I believe it was originally called The Whale, and he and his brother Alan decided that it needed a more catchy title. And they also decided that Moby Dick was the actual hero of the book, so that it should be named after him. And from the very first instance of the use of Moby Dick as the title, it had the hyphen. So it was something a copy editor would have done. A copy editor would have just hyphenated that title. It would have been the copy editor's job to hyphenate that title. So it was a lot of fun, actually, tracking that down. I found myself deep in the footnotes of the most scholarly edition of Moby Dick.
Oh, my good. And where does that exist?
Well, it exists, I think, in the Library of America series, because they use a very scholarly edition that I should have the name at my fingertips here, but maybe I can find it quickly in the book. I love that hyphen chapter. I've decided that chapter, oddly enough, is the heart of the book. I don't quite know how it happened, but... there's a lot of passion in the hyphens, it seems. So
do you like commas?
Yes, I do. I like
you
commas.
Do. Are you a fan of the Oxford comma, then?
I am. I still call it the serial comma. But I think it's a very kind of a spiffy mark. It just... starches the prose somehow and makes it crisper. It looks better dressed.
So if we were going to the store to buy apples, oranges, and bananas, you would put that comma before the "and bananas"?
I would.
See, I would fight you for that. I would say no comma.
Because it's because of the word "and"? You don't think it's necessary?
I don't think it's necessary because of the "and." No. I think it's a simple thing, and why add it if you don't need it?
Well, you have a point. The important thing, I think it's wonderful that people have such strong feelings about commas. And the important thing is in your writing, in your published writing, to be consistent with it. I find it's easier to be consistent with the serial comma because it's never wrong, and it does help prevent ambiguity in some cases. And I know that those cases are actually fairly rare. But, you know, it's also just what you're used to.
Sure. And actually that consistency, I think, is a really strong point. And that's something as a teacher that I tell my students as well. To be honest, I don't care whether they use it or not, as long as whichever style that they choose, that they stick with it from beginning to end. And I'm curious, you know, something that when I'm talking with other writers and with students as well is one of my schools of thought is I don't care if you can describe to me what a dangling modifier is, but I care if you are able to catch one. And if you use one, you're able to recognize something is wrong in your writing, even though you may not know that it's a dangling modifier or something similar to that. I'm just curious, as a grammarian, you know, how do you feel about that? Is it important to understand the rules as well as be able to apply them?
Oh, certainly. I don't really think there's much point in applying them if you don't know why you're doing it. It helps, certainly helps you remember why you should do it if you understand the grammar behind it, and that whatever begins the sentence should apply to the subject of the sentence. They are sneaky, those danglers. You know, you think you're saying, if you know what you're saying, you think that's what it says, right? But there is something unbalanced about a sentence with a dangling modifier in it. Maybe sometimes a writer could argue that she was going for that sense of imbalance.
<You know? laughs> That would be a sneaky thing to say, too. That would be a sneaky writer, as well as using a sneaky piece of grammar.
Yes, it would. I wouldn't be sure that she was very sincere, as a matter of fact, but just trying to defend something, basically, it's not totally indefensible. I've gotten a little more tolerant of dangling modifiers just because they can be so hard to fix sometimes. And you have to be able to, you know, if you are going, sometimes the way the sentence is creates a mood that is just hard to recreate, to reconstruct once you've fixed the dangler. It's odd.
Yes, it is. And now your book, Between You and Me, is going to take you on a lovely tour that's going to include you coming to Boston in the middle of April. Are you excited to meet with readers?
Oh, yes. As I said earlier, I've been wanting to be a published writer for decades, and I am very excited to be going out and sharing the good word and meeting people. So far, everyone I've met has been just so nice. And I was in a class yesterday up at Columbia University where the students, they were in a writing course, a graduate writing course, had read the book and had the book on the desks with them, and I signed books for some of them afterward, and it was very exciting. I love seeing people read it.
And how does it feel to have this book that you've mentioned a couple of times now, how much you wanted to write a book? Now you do have a book with your name on it, and you're holding it in your hand. Like, do you sit there and stare at it and say, wow?
Well, you can't do that for the rest of your life. You know? When I first received copies, of course, I was very excited and hugged them to me and posed for a picture. And I do have the book on the desk in front of me as we're talking, and of course I am very proud of it, but I will have to go on and write another one at some point. You just can't sit around and stare at your first book.
Absolutely not. And you know what? You don't sound to me like the type of person who would sit around and stare at it. You sound to me like someone who would be, okay, what's next?
Well, that's exactly how I feel. I'm very excited about the upcoming tour, and it's going to, I think, keep me really busy. I'm still a full-time employee at The New Yorker. I'll have to take a leave of absence to go on tour. And sometimes I have to say that, you know, I enjoy giving interviews and talking with people and going places, and I'm making this video series for The New Yorker now about grammar. And sometimes it's such a relief to just go to work and just have to proofread something. And not have to promote anything or appear before a camera. So I'm still getting this funny pleasure out of my job. It's kind of a relief to just be doing my job.
Isn't that interesting? I love how you're doing the video series. And is that going to be something that's on the New Yorker site or on YouTube or?
Both. I believe it can be found on both. I know it starts out on the New Yorker site, and I don't know how it works, but it migrates very quickly to YouTube. Maybe the New Yorker has its own channel or something.
It probably does. And actually, I am staring right now at your Twitter page. You are Mary Norris. T-N-Y, on Twitter. And so I'm assuming that when these videos are released or you come up with new dates or new articles or new appearances or whatever, you're going to tweet about them so we can find out where you're going to be and what's new.
Yes, for sure. I also have a website, comaqueen.net, and that information will be on there too, about the tour.
And so now I'm curious, as you tweet, are you careful about your punctuation when you are on Twitter?
If I am trying to write something, you know, in the 140 characters, I try very hard to count all the punctuation. I know that it's what would be sacrificed if you had to sacrifice something. And I've seen that people just can not use up a space devoted to the period, just leave a space and then start with a capital letter. And it's eloquent. You know, people know that that's a sentence and are doing without the punctuation. The important thing is to get across what you're trying to communicate. In my case, it would be very important not to let any typos slip through. More important probably than punctuation, although I do try to leave space for all the bells and whistles, yes.
I do that too. Even when I text people as well, I always use proper capitalization and punctuation. I can't say, you know, between letter U and I with a lowercase I. I can't do that. Never.
Well, you would never say between you and I anyway, right?
No, I know, but I know you're right. I would never say that. That's right. I would never, ever, ever say that.
Now, I feel that if it takes an extra effort to do it the easy way with all lowercase letters and no punctuation, then you can't do it. To me, I always think it's like remembering your mother's birthday. If you remember your mother's birthday, you call, right? You don't say, well, it's mom's birthday, I don't feel like calling, I'm going to deliberately not call. It's easier to call, and it's the right thing to do. So that's how I feel about proper punctuation and capitalization. It's just what looks natural to me, and if I have to put extra effort into being casual, then I don't see the point of that. You know?
I love you, Mary.
Thank you, Cindy.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I love everything that you have to say. I love your book. I think everybody should read it. What's your pitch for the book? Why should people pick it up?
Well, I think really above all, I think people will get a laugh out of it. And I hope fervently that actually just by looking at the cover and seeing the title Between You and Me, it will seep in that they should say me and not I in that case. And I hope that people will understand that it's not that hard. This is not rocket science. Grammar is not that difficult. People speak all the time and communicate and know what each other is saying. And I would love for people to see what goes on in a publication and how a copy editor makes decisions. And I would also love for people to see that a copy editor is not a really mean witch, but is somebody who is just trying to uphold some standards and who loves the language and is trying to cultivate it the best that she can and hopes other people will too.
Mary, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you. It's been fun, Cindy.
Remember what Mary said, don't take the easy way out when it comes to proper punctuation and capitalization. Always do the right thing and do it right. If you want more specifics on what else Mary wants you to do, you can read Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen by winning a copy right here. Tweet me at @LitNewEngland or email me at LitNewEngland@gmail.com and you might be the lucky winner. I'm so grateful to Marisa de los Santos, Mary Norris, and Charles Finch for talking with me and being on tonight's show. Visit Literary New England's Tumblr page for more book giveaways, author talk, and author event information, as well as to listen to past episodes of the Literary New England radio show. All kinds of great content there. We have a couple of terrific book giveaways coming up this week, and we're getting ready for some upcoming tweet chats with Allison Pataki, Greer McAllister, Sarah McCoy, and Erica Roebuck. You can find details about all of these events by going to our Tumblr page, which is litnewengland.tumblr.com. I'll be back again next Monday night with another terrific episode of the Literary New England Radio Show. Until then, have a great week and great reading.